This is the Real Rebel Podcast, and you're listening to the Rebel Chats edition.
This is for the people who push the boundaries of our society, for the people who live on the fringe, for the people who aren't afraid to question the status quo and live life as exactly who they are, not as who they should be. These are the people who make us uncomfortable, who speak truth and break glass ceilings, who aren't afraid to stand up and face themselves, who refuse to be oppressed and help us expand and evolve the edges of humanity. These are the real rebels. And this podcast is for them. Hey, it's your host, Katie B, and thanks so much for tuning into this guest episode of the Real Rebel Podcast. As always, it is an absolute pleasure and honor to have you tuning in. And if you're here for the first time ever, you have picked a dang good episode to come into, because today I am talking to John Lupin, or you might better know him as the Poetry Bandit. And John is a published poet and author, and if you want to check out his work, you can easily find him on Instagram at @_poetrybandit. And very quickly, you will see all of his incredible work there. And trust me, you're going to want to give yourself some time, because it's very easy to dive in and get lost in his writing. And he also has 3 books out: My Sober Moon, You Only Love Me When I'm Suffering, and Encyclopedia of a Broken Heart. And the conversation you're about to listen to is incredibly powerful, incredibly vulnerable, and really highly informative. John does an incredible job of giving an insight into his journey with alcoholism and OCD. And he actually opened my eyes to something called Pure OT, which I had never heard of before. And really, I don't want to talk too much because I want to just get right on into the conversation, but a quick glimpse. A few things that we talk about are conquering resentment, self-acceptance, how he got started doing his poetry work, and John's story is one of truly powerful transformation and just realness. The information he shares is incredibly helpful, not only if you're struggling with some kind of addiction, but just if you're struggling in general and you feel challenged, this episode will offer you a lot in the way of support. And as always, anything that we mention in this episode, including links to all of John's books and everything else, can be found over at realrebelpodcast.com, and you'll find it there in the show notes. So with that, I will just move us right along into this conversation with John Lupin, the Poetry Bandit. So we can just get going. Welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Katie.
And so much of what this podcast is about is the hero's journey and essentially just helping people come to the place of living a life that is true to them and the bravery and the courage that's involved in that. And you, I feel like just doing a small even scan through, you know, what you have out there, I see a lot of that in your life and what you've done. And I'm getting way ahead of myself because I get really excited about people's stories. But first and foremost, how are you today and where are you today? And we were just talking, I don't want to make it all about, you know, what's going on and the isolation and stuff, but I think it is kind of helpful to share like really what comes up during this time of isolation. And even when this comes out, it might be past, but I think it's happening now.
It'll always be relevant, I guess, at some point now looking ahead, right? Because personally, I don't know if this will ever go away. That's the part of it that I'm struggling with is the lack of control I have over the narrative now. And as someone with OCD, giving up control is a daily battle. And also as an alcoholic in recovery, it's a daily battle. So it's kind of a double whammy for me as dealing with being apart from other people who are sober, and then also being alone with that lack of control. So practicing, remember to practice all my all the things in my toolkit in terms of dealing with the fear, dealing with the loneliness, dealing with the lack of control over what's going to happen. So yeah, I think overall I'm doing pretty good. Early on, I had some bad days, but now slowly but surely, we're settling into a new normal. And of course, there's going to be homeschooling. I've got three kids that I share part-time with my ex. And trying to figure out how homeschooling is going to go. I think that's the biggest thing for me right now. It's just taking one day at a time and tackling one problem at a time. So How are you doing?
Well, I lived, I want to get into, I think you're like a wizard at heartbreak, you know, and moving through heartbreak. I just feel just based on your writing, which is incredible. But I lived after a major heartbreak in 2018. I moved to Bali for 6 months and I had this idea about what it would be. And I would be out and doing these things. I'd be this like incredible Bali lady. And, you know, really what happened was I stayed inside my place for 6 months by myself and found a cat. And like, that was pretty much it. And so I'm actually very familiar and used to being alone, but it comes with its challenges. I think like you can get, I personally get lost in it and I become too used to being alone. And like yesterday, I get so much joy from taking a drive. Like I grew up, my dad was a mechanic, so there were always cars in the driveway. And I love to just like hit the road and go for a drive. And I did that for the first time. I left my house in 12 freaking days yesterday.
Wow.
And I just,
good for you.
Yeah, I just was in tears, like crying as I was driving. I was like, oh yeah, this is what it feels like to be a human.
Like, yeah, I went for a drive yesterday too, and I was really emotional about it. It was like, and I was surprised at how many other people were on the road, and I'm pretty sure they were all thinking the same thing. Like, I just got to get out of here.
Well, because you can go for a drive, and it's like you're not like breathing on anybody. You're just going for
That's
a drive,
right.
And yeah. So, but like we were saying before too, like I think because you are taken out of your environment of the things that you even like subtly use to numb yourself or to avoid yourself, I think that those are all pretty much gone and you're left, other than like the contents in your fridge, like you're left with like your raw self and you have no choice but to face yourself on a different level, and all your stuff comes up, even like getting uncomfortable with boredom. It's so uncomfortable to be bored. Like,
oh, it is. Yeah. And when my kids are over there, we're bored, right? And so there's that, and trying to find different ways to make sure that they're entertained. And when school kicks in, then, you know, there'll be a lot of online learning and things like that. But my son, who has autism, has taken to languages. So he's got this app that's teaching him how to speak Swedish and Spanish, Dutch,
Holy
and
smokes.
Something else. So he's good,
wow.
Which is great. So he's like hyper-focused on just keeping himself. And he did that all on his own, which is great because he always knows when he's about to stim out. And that usually happens when there's a lack of routine.
Right.
And so my girls are like, he's sandwiched between two girls. And so one's a teenager and one's 7 years old. So It's kind of like, what are they going to do? And everybody's at a different age. Everybody's doing different things. So, So it'll be a bit of a challenge to, like you said, conquer that boredom and find something to do, because school isn't coming back anytime soon, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a, there's so many different ways to look at it. There was, I think it was Kristen Bell or her school principal, whatever, sent a message out and was like, you guys are like focusing so much on homeschooling. How about just relax? But then my brother-in-law, who's a teacher, or he's a vice principal, and he was saying last night, we were doing a big family Zoom call, as you know, we never have done before. So there's a pro from that. It's quite hilarious. But he was saying that they're trying to do something online and it's going to be big and clunky and weird and like hard to manage. But the kids need like some kind of structure, like just to create that sense of like peace, I think, and safety.
Yeah. And kids need that. Like, the one thing I've learned as a parent and early on was routine is key. And it's actually really more for the parents too, because while the kids see it as a safety blanket, the parent actually relies on the routine for sanity.
Mm-hmm.
And now that that's kind of out the window, you've got to force yourself to create a new routine. And we just can't all sleep in and watch TV every day. So that would be nice. But I mean, at some point the kids go, I've watched every show in Netflix. It's boring now.
Yeah.
There's only so many times I can rewatch Turbo, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, oh, you know, We'll figure it out, right? We got to do it together. So
yeah. Yeah. For I saw on your Instagram stories, you're watching The Office. I think it was, it's like my go-to background show.
Absolutely, man. That has saved me actually in the evening. I'm watching it with my teen right now. She's 13 going on 14. And we started watching a few months ago, and now we're at the second last season.
Oof.
And we're like season 9, episode 21. And I was just bawling my eyes out. And I was like, wow, I had actually forgotten like how emotional that entire last season was. And like, I'm finding that the need to laugh is increasing in me. Like, I'm a pretty goofy guy. And so I've been relying on that sense of humor and leaving hilarious voicemails for friends. And yeah, kind of like a mix of Andy, Michael, and Jim. Like, that's kind of my personality.
Excellent blend.
Excellent blend. And every once in a while, I can get Dwight on my kids too, right? Oof. So it's kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
He might be my... It's a cross between Michael and Dwight for me, my two favorites. Like, they're just... Yeah. They're just wild. But I totally agree. I think it's so important to laugh, like, and just to try and focus on the lightness. It's like a balance between focusing on, you know, the lightness, so you're not sinking too deep into the fear energy that's going around, but at the same time keeping a steady like understanding of what's going on. And it can become too much because I think everyone's talking about it. And it can be a lot. You at some point you're just like, enough. Like, I know it's here. I don't need to hear about it anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's that laugh, that laughter, the silliness. You just gotta like bring it in wherever you can.
Yeah, and you can tell you're stressed when you're laughing at stuff that wouldn't usually make you laugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was watching a stand-up comic, and I'm like, this is not funny, but why am I laughing? And so I was like, okay, well, yeah, I guess that's where I'm at right now. And it was good because I felt like once I started to laugh, it was easier to get to that point where I could cry and let it all out. Because about 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, I was 2 years into sobriety. I was diagnosed with severe OCD. Mm-hmm. And I always knew I had OCD because everybody would always make fun of how clean my apartment was or how I liked to just everything had its place. And that was sort of an external part. But the real severe part of my OCD is an internal thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very easy for me to spiral when the future is uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
So flying is a big fear of mine because I can't control it. I'd rather drive everywhere, even though I know it's more dangerous than flying. I can control my vehicle.
Right. Yeah.
I cannot control a plane. So one of the things that when I first went into the doctor, I was 2 years into sobriety, and it was why I drank the way I did, like before I quit drinking in 2015. I was drinking 2 to 3 bottles of wine in the evening alone. And that didn't include what I drank at lunch or what I was drinking in the evening after the wine was all gone. And really, I was trying to silence this internal monologue I had that never stopped about fear, uncertainty. At some point, at the worst point, I was following white vans around thinking that there were people inside or children being kidnapped. Like at one point I followed a white van to a job site, and I even like opened up the door in the back while the guy was in the house building his house or whatever.
Yeah.
Seeing if there were people inside. Like that's how crazy it got. And I was like, wow, okay, this is not good. And eventually I couldn't manage how I dealt with other people. And this kind of led to the failure of my marriage as well. I shouldn't say failure, more of a parting of ways, but my ex-wife just couldn't handle the distrust that I had in her because I could not ever reason with my mind that what she was doing on her phone or where she was going or what she was thinking, like none of it. I was never able to just let it be who she was, or I could never let it go. And then that started to, I started to fixate on what my kids were doing and then other people who I had no business in. It wasn't that I was nosy or I needed to have control. Yeah, well, I had to have control over everything in my life. And so that translated into business. And then that translated into friendships and relationships with family. So it just wasn't a thing with my marriage. It was everything. It was everywhere. It was in my recovery program. It was, like I could never find happiness because I was always worried. And so I went to the doctor and I said, I think this is a problem again, because it wasn't the first time I had seen him. And we did one of those tests, right? They score you out of 42. And it was just how are you feeling about certain things? And then you score 1 through 4. And I scored a 39 out of 42. And I was like, I know how to pass a test still. And he looked at me and said, no, this is bad. This is really bad. And I knew it was bad. Like, I was crying while I was doing the test, right? Mm. And that's part of how my humor translates into trying to make me feel better about a situation. And he said, okay, well, let's put you on something. And I remember he tried to put me on Cipralex once before, and I was drinking at that time. Like, I had told people I had quit, but I was secretly drinking. And that was 2014. And it didn't work out, obviously. It made everything worse because I was still drinking. And so we tried something else, Trintellix, and I've been on that since 2017. And it changed my life. Like, it just gives me the opportunity to step back, because I tried everything else. Self-help books. I tried relying totally on spiritual experience, my higher power. I tried just putting everything I had into my recovery program. And for 2 years, nothing worked. So medication was the way we had to go.
I think that that's sometimes a spiritual experience in itself, because we have these controlled ideas around what spirituality is and what it looks like. And that's not spirituality. That's judgment and confining an experience to a certain way of being. Western medicine exists on the earth, and it's incredibly helpful, just as Eastern medicine, just as spirituality. So I think that it's like, if it works for you, like, fuck what anybody, you know.
There you go. So the other thing was too, like, I had just focused on one thing at a time. I wasn't combining a number of things together. And I wasn't looking at coming out of my OCD like I should have, because I came out of alcoholism and I got sober, but it was because I combined a bunch of different things, a recovery program, people like me I could talk to, my writing, which kind of folds into this conversation, therapy, telling people, being vulnerable. Like, I put that all together when I wanted to come out of alcoholism, and I wasn't doing that with my OCD. I was just sort of hanging on to it like it was part of my identity and I had to just live with it.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it was such a big part of who I was, like keeping my apartment neat and being clean. And I was like the clean guy in the odd couple, right? Everything always had to be in its place. And that was an external way of dealing with stress, because my main job is in the insurance industry. So I'm always surrounded by a stressful thing or a stressful conversation. And when I discovered alcohol and I had free rein and ability to purchase it and to have it around me all the time, it just eventually spiraled out of control as my stress spiraled out of control. And that just comes along with growing a family and having 3 kids and my wife at the time, we had 2 miscarriages and she became bipolar, and the family health issues. And then my son was diagnosed with autism. And then, you know,
you were climbing some high mountains there.
I was climbing some high mountains. Absolutely. And the only way I could like get to next base camp was like polish off 3 bottles of wine. And I would do that every day. Like, yeah. I was 40 pounds overweight, and my feet were burning every night. Diabetes runs in the family, right? So I was like pre-diabetic as well. And my face was always red. And my feet were always swollen and felt like garbage. And I just figured that was stress. But no, that was like the 3 bottles of wine I was putting inside of me every day. So when I quit, I lost some of that weight and things. So I thought that would cure everything. But really, the reason I drank wasn't the alcohol that was the problem. It was my OCD. It was this, what they call pure OT, so pure obsessive thinking, which is a subcontext of obsessive compulsive disorder. Everybody thinks, oh, it's hand washing and flicking lights and stuff like that. But it was never like that for me. I like to keep things clean, but it was really this obsessive thinking that just nobody talks about when they think about OCD. And so I'm trying to change that narrative as I share my journey. And I'm so thankful that you invited me on, because I think that's the part of OCD that people need to talk about more.
Yeah.
People go, well, you know, he's a control freak. Well, what does that really mean?
Yeah.
You know, we might be mislabeling some people out there that actually suffer from pure OT and need to address that with their doctors as a form of obsessive compulsive disorder. And that was my story. Like, yeah, I like to keep things neat, but I wasn't washing my hands like Jack Nicholson on As Good As It Gets. Like, that wasn't OCD for me. And that's what people think of, right? They think of that narrative.
Yeah, that's all you ever like hear about. And I'm really curious then for people listening, and you've probably said it already, but just to like solidify it, what is pure, you said pure OTC?
Pure OT. So
OT.
Pure obsessive thinking. So that is like you have this inability to control where the thought goes. Mm. So it might start off like, I'll give you an example. And my ex is okay with me giving these examples, but I would see her on the couch on her phone. And my first thought was she's talking to another man. And I would then follow that thought. And then I call it my movie mind. I would play that out and it would spiral. In less than 5 minutes, she'd be packing her bags and leaving me. And I'd be there with 3 kids mm-hmm. crying on the doorstep. And then my business fails because she's no longer there. And on and on and on it goes until I'm living in a ditch drinking out of a bottle. And that would all happen and spiral in about 5 minutes.
Right.
And then a panic attack would ensue. And I began to feel like I was actually trying to manipulate her by allowing myself to spiral like this so that she wouldn't be on her phone, which is ridiculous because all she was doing was playing Candy Crush.
Right.
And until I could come around and see what she was doing on her phone, I wouldn't be able to let go of that spiraling thought. Now, some people may think that I was trying to control her, but if you talk to her, she would tell you that it had nothing to do with trying to control her. It was all fear-based. And then it was like that for some time. And then it started to become more like, hey, what is my neighbor doing? What's going on in his shed? And then thinking about breaking laws to go and satisfy my hunger for the truth. And so one of the coping mechanisms that I had a therapist try and teach me was closing doors. So he kind of likened it to being in a hallway and every single door being open and everything in all of those rooms flowing out at once. That's what pure obsessive thinking is like, is that you have a hallway floor of like 100 doors and they're all open and everything that's in those rooms spilling out into the hallway. And you feel like the only way that you can get through that hallway is to just clean up everything that's spilling out of those rooms.
Right. It's like the only way you can get relief is like by following every single thread and like, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
And it was spiraling and it was relentless and it was every day, every moment of every day. Someone would say something to me, wouldn't matter. Like, hey, I'm going to the store. I'm like, what store? Where are you going? What are you buying? Who are you seeing? Where are you stopping? Where are you going? Are you going to be drinking? Are you going to bring alcohol home? Because I'm not comfortable with that. And on it would go until you'd branch out into a million different things and you're just going to go get eggs.
Right. And then you're lost in it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So in 2017, before I went to the doctor again, I was ready to just jump in front of a truck or go and drink myself into a ditch because I had screwed up so many times in my relationship with my ex at the time that it was worse than when I was drinking. Mm. She was like, I'd take you as an alcoholic over this any day. Mm. I'm like, wow,
that must have been tough. Yeah, to hear.
Very hard.
Yeah.
Very hard to hear. So I went for a walk. And the first thing I did was I called my sponsor because someone in my recovery program once told a story that, you know, they were ready to end it too. And the best thing they ever did was called somebody who they loved or they trusted to tell them what their plans were. Mm. So I called my sponsor and I told him I was ready to just sort of, I was thinking about making a plan. And he said, okay, before you go ahead and do that, why don't we just talk about it and go to a meeting? So I was like, okay, I guess that's a good idea. Because I really didn't want to end it, mm-hmm. right? Because I love my kids and I loved, you know, the potential of what was out there for me. If I could just get through this, but it felt hopeless. And yeah, he brought me back to square one and told me, go to the doctor. So that's when I went to the doctor and I got on Trintellix and within a month or two, everything had changed. I felt like I was able to take a step back every time before I was about to spiral. And the funny part was, like, never once during any of this, when I was struggling so hard with my OCD, did I think about going back to drinking. So the obsession to drink had left, and I had always hung on to that as a complete win. And I guess that's why I didn't deal with the OCD sooner, is because I felt like I had conquered that desire to drink. So I kind of left everything else alone, which was a mistake, because the reason I drank was because I had OCD.
You were just looking for some relief from the consistent, you know, onslaught of,
yeah.
You must have felt like, what did it feel like when you first started to shift? You know, you were, what was it called again? You were taking the
Trintellix.
Trintellix. What was it like? What did it feel like when you started to feel like release from that, from your...
Well, if I'm going to put it in a poetic way, it was kind of like waking up. It was very similar to how I got sober. Like there, like when I got sober, there were withdrawals. There was post-acute withdrawal syndrome, where your brain is constantly rewiring. And then it slowly but surely reality becomes brighter, colors are brighter, tastier, like everything has a different feel. And it was the same way. Like, this medication didn't make me feel like a zombie. It didn't make me like my libido was pretty good. Like, I didn't gain any weight. You know, it had zero side effects other than making me yawn like crazy at 2 p.m. in the afternoon. And it was just about finding a routine. And once I started to know when to take it, my days became like, I thought, oh, I just remember waking up one day and going, wow, this is what normal people, they wake up with no fear, no anxiety, nothing to spin out about, like no worries about what happened the night before or what's going to happen later on today. Like, you just wake up and you see the sunrise and you're like, wow, that's the day.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was just, it was like a waking up and just having a veil lifted. And I loved it. And yeah, and I've been on it since, and I never miss a day. And the nice part about this medication is as well, that is if I do miss a day, I just continue on like I had taken it the day before, and nothing really, there's no real bad side effects. So it's great. Like, yeah, and it opened up my eyes to quite a few things. And I was able actually to do a set of steps with my ex at the time where we decided that we were going to part ways. And I didn't cry at all when she moved out. And I felt like in the last couple of years leading up to this, that I had done a lot of work in my recovery program with my therapist, the medication, exercise, all to the point where I felt pretty good about being able to counter any negative situation happening in my life. And yeah, it's all credit to being sober, having a recovery program, understanding the science behind the OCD, the medication, just understanding, like just filling my head with knowledge and coping mechanisms and tools and doing what's prescribed to me in the way that the doctors wanted it to see happen. And but the biggest, I think the biggest part of it was, and just circling back to who I am on Instagram, is my writing was just forming a huge part of that journey. Because when I decided to get sober, and then 2 years after that, dealing with my OCD, this constant evolution of being vulnerable in every situation and every challenge that I was facing, that was who I was a vulnerable person who wasn't afraid to share negative feelings, sadness, heartbreak, and taking responsibility for what I had done and being okay with that, forgiving myself, forgiving other people. And that's how I approached this divorce. Was the drinking had taken its toll, and the 5 years leading up to the separation from when I got sober was just about getting ourselves mentally fit to be able to address that and amicably walk away from the marriage. And now we have a really great co-parenting relationship, and we're very good friends, and people don't understand it at all, but it works really well for us. And our kids have dealt with this whole thing very, very well. We've had a lot of people say that it was very weird to see kids coming from a quote unquote broken home, being so happy and so full of life, and didn't really see a change in their attitudes. Yeah, there was some stress and there was some crying. And but as they saw that mom and dad weren't fighting, we weren't angry with each other, like we never fought in front of the kids, like they didn't really see any difference other than the fact that mom and dad weren't living in the same home anymore. And to be honest, I think, you know, my teen said the other day that things are really good.
That must be so nice to hear.
It is. And it just makes me feel like my ability to deal with resentment and not allow my OCD to spiral that resentment into something greater than it is, gives me the ability to deal with it so it doesn't turn into something crazy. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing how everything has kind of fit together nicely. Like the OCD is being dealt with the medication that gives me the ability to live my sober recovery program in a way that it's supposed to be done. And living without resentment is something I write about on a regular basis. So being vulnerable, dealing with resentments, dealing with heartbreak, dealing with, you know, feelings of addiction. And that's all part of, you know, why I became the Poetry Bandit. Initially, I call myself the Poetry Bandit. So I was stealing my love of language and writing back from my addiction to alcohol. And now it means a lot more because I'm stealing a lot of other things back from, you know, other terrible things that's, you know, that happened. So, yeah.
Oof. Yeah. I feel like, oof. I have just so many questions. I'm trying to like organize my brain right now and be like, okay, which one is the one I really want to talk about? There's so many things. The vulnerability, like I think so many people, first of all, I want to really, you know, honor you for being vulnerable and sharing your story the way that you have. I think that the reason why your kids, and you alluded to this, feel that steadiness is because you have done that work and you're coming at this, you know, you and your ex-wife are coming at this from a place of steadiness, and they can feel that and feed off that. And I think that's incredibly powerful. And you are incredibly vulnerable in your work. I'm really curious, where did the writing come in? When did that start, and how did that help you through? Because I think, you know, the creative process is so incredibly therapeutic. And my second question weaves into this as well, around vulnerability and like being vulnerable and allowing yourself to be vulnerable through your work. It's such a, for many, especially if you're an empathic person, a sensitive person, it can be a challenge to allow yourself to put yourself out there and speak your most like inner truths, and to do it in a way that's beautiful and creative and all of these kinds of things. Like, it's not easy. And so I'm just curious as to when the writing came in and how it started to unfold in conjunction with your journey.
It's pretty interesting. Every time I tell this story, it gives me a little bit of goosebumps. So in 2014, actually, it was the Christmas of 2013. I had had a really terrible blackout in Vancouver. And that was kind of my MO. With a couple of underwriters from insurance companies, because I worked in the insurance industry. And we would have a couple glasses of wine at lunch, and then I would spiral out of control and find my way home somehow. And it was on one of these benders that I came home. It was like, I don't even know, 2 a.m. And my ex-wife was in the kitchen, and she was like, this has got to stop. Like, you know, you didn't answer your phone for 8 hours and everybody was worried about you. And I was like standing in the kitchen in my Italian suit with a piece of pizza in my pocket. And I went, you got it, Toots. And I pulled out this piece of pizza and passed out on the couch. I don't even know what kind of pizza it was. I have no idea how it got there either. So we hold on to the war stories to remember how bad it was.
Yeah, so, that's the truth.
And most of my war stories are hilarious. So,
yeah, I can't say I've ever found pizza in my pocket just randomly.
Well, you just imagine some guy in a suit wandering around the downtown East Side, wondering where he parked his car after shutting down the number 5, right? So, like, that was that's what I did when I was blacked out, I guess. And anyway, so I said, okay, 2014's my year, right? So it's literally the year where all the worst shit happened. So
isn't that the way it goes, though? You like say to the universe, like, you're like, I'm ready to do it. Yeah. And the universe is like, okay, you need to deal with all your shit first. So here it is. Like, walk through it now. And it's,
yeah. Well, 2020, we had the same thing. It's going to be our year. And every month, something terrible has happened. So 2014 started off great. I made a conscientious effort to be sober. And I got, on a regular basis, I got would get like a couple of weeks in, a month in, and then I'd fail. And then I dealt with my OCD first that year, and my doctor put me on the Ciprolex, and I was drinking, and I just made everything even worse. And I became violent. I never hit anybody, but I became violent inside, and I just couldn't deal with it. So I went off that drug, and then the wife and I were really fighting a lot, texting, because she feels more comfortable communicating negative feelings through text. And so I was, you know, that was happening. And then work was changing, and I quit a company that I worked at for almost 18 years. And I'd grown up in, I was director of sales at the time. And I decided I had to quit that job in order to get sober, because I just couldn't do it there anymore. I ran a winery insurance program. As the good alcoholic that I was, I created a winery insurance program. And I developed a problem with the product, right? Yeah. So I was the wine guy. Everybody knew me as the wine insurance guy. And that was my thing. And that year, and then our son was diagnosed with autism that December of 2014. And I had spent that entire year struggling with so much stuff. I just went on another bender that Christmas. And it was even worse than the year before. And entering into 2015, I didn't know what was happening. But funny enough, like just before that last bender, my ex came home with a typewriter, and she said, I want to start writing about my journey, because she had been diagnosed with bipolar 2 a few years before, and she was just coming out of that. And we had done a lot of work there. And I looked at it, and I was like, I might be worth looking into, because I had been, at that point, I was maybe a couple of weeks sober again, and I was having a lot of pity parties, and I didn't really know what to do with my time. So I started doing this, and I was like, cool, maybe I should give it a shot. So I started writing. I popped on Instagram. I created an account. I was known as the hopeless loser. And so I ended up writing about some of these feelings I was having about being sober. Now, this doesn't come from anywhere strange, because before I became this corporate dude, I was a singer-songwriter, and I wrote fantasy novels, and I wrote short stories, and I wrote a couple of screenplays, and one screenplay got $27 million in funding, and like I was a creative guy. And I had lost all that when I became this corporate dude, and then I got into wine, and then I got into, you know, my addiction, and my stress, and my OCD started to take over my life, and I lost all of that ability to create. And now here I am laying on this couch trying to stay sober, and I'm losing my mind. And my ex walks in with this typewriter, and it literally changed my life. It's like right up there with getting sober and getting an OCD medication, because I started to write. I started to share. I was anonymous. Nobody in my family or my social circle knew that I was writing. And I was sharing all these sensitive things. And I was connecting with people all around the world that were struggling with the same things. And so through creating this pseudonym and this persona online, I met some people who were very instrumental in helping me actually drop the drink altogether. So July 29th, 2015 was my last drink. So from that time in October, November, 2014 until July, 2015, I was writing, but I was still drinking, and it was a mess. My writing was a mess. It was all over the place, but I was doing it. I was writing it. I was meeting people. I was getting help. I was just talking to other people.
You just started where you were at. You just.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then 2015, when I did get sober, I made a conscientious effort to start being more vulnerable, start to talk about the underlying issues with my drinking, writing about it, using the typewriter more often than I was using an app or something, and just getting down and dirty with it. And before I knew it, by the end of 2016, I had enough for a book. And so I put a book out there. I just self-published it through Amazon. And, you know, people who were struggling like I had were buying it. And I was like, that's a win. I don't need to be famous here. I don't need to have It doesn't need to be in every bookstore. It just needs to help people. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so the writing came in when I needed it the most and rekindled this love of poetry, because I have an English literature degree, but I just, I followed the money instead of my passion, right? And so, and the insurance industry has always been very good to me. It's paid my bills and I do have a love for it and I do understand it well. And I love the people I get to interact with. But, you know, if I'm being honest, my heart and my soul are really in writing and creating art. And finding that voice and finding the Poetry Bandit was a real big part of how I stayed sober, because it gave me the ability to reach people who are also struggling. And so every week today, 2020, I'm talking about four or five different people. They're all struggling or are sober. And that's like every week, four to five new people that reach out asking for help. And I love it. And that's the way that I give back. And so it's opened up a world to me, because, and to answer that, that leads into the second part of your question, is the only way that you can really reach people is by being vulnerable. And I'd always been the kind of guy that just never cared what other people thought. If you talk to anybody, if you talk to anybody who knew me in high school, as I became more self-deprecating and more humorous, by the time I was in grade 11, grade 12, I didn't care what people thought or what I want. I cracked the jokes I wanted to. And I'm still kind of, I'm still like that today. You know, nobody tells me what to do. So I would have people email me or DM me on my Instagram, "You should write about men more." I said, "Don't tell me what to do. I'll write what I want." You know,
that's so powerful. I think so many of us get wrapped up in the shoulds, and with my writing as well too, I catch myself at times as well, as there's a moment I want to write about it that's real. And then there's this other part of me that's like, well, you should be talking a little bit more about, you know, this subject or whatever. And it's like, whenever I do that and I put a post out, the reaction is like vastly different. And it's just being real, because I think in essence, people just want to know, like, they're not alone in the way that they feel. It's just such a powerful thing. It's such a powerful thing. And you get so much feeling of like purpose that you're helping people the way that you are.
Absolutely. Like, if you had asked me like 6 years ago, what I had hoped to achieve by quitting drinking, like this, like I would have sold myself short. Mm-hmm. You know, like this life that I live today is full of blessings, and it's contact with my higher power. It's contact with other people who struggle. It's contact with people who have succeeded and have gone before me and have succeeded. It's a renewed love of my children and the possibilities that the future holds, you know, a great relationship with my ex-wife, which is like key to keeping resentments away from ruining my sobriety, because resentment will always lead back to drinking if you let it sit there.
Why is that?
In my program and in my recovery, and one of the main things you do in a 12-step recovery program is, you know, the first three steps are like admitting you were powerless over alcohol and that there's something out there bigger than you that you can rely on. And for me, I choose to call that higher power God. And it's a God of my own understanding. And that understanding that higher power is key. I grew up in a Christian home and I grew up going to church and I still do. But I understand God a lot differently now than I did when I was a kid. And it's a more spiritual relationship. And it's complicated, as all spiritual relationships can be, but it's key for me, because if I understand that I'm forgiven for things that I've done, it makes it a lot easier for me to forgive others and to forgive myself. And that's been key for me in just, you know, running through my steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Those are the hard ones. Those are the ones where people stop and they go back out and they relapse and they die. They OD. You know, and I didn't do them right away. And that's why I kept failing and not really addressing the issues in my life. And yeah, addressing my obsessive compulsive disorder and forgiving myself. Yeah, I didn't really need to be forgiven because it was a mental health issue, but I felt like I needed to address that inside and be okay with the fact that this is part of who I am. And that's how I can also be vulnerable about it as well, because it is a part of who I am and it'll never go away, but I can manage it so that I can live in this world around other people and not alienate them or not alienate myself. And like those steps, they show you where your resentments lie. And I had a big resentment against God. I had a big resentment against certain friends. I had a big resentment against church. I had a huge resentment against my ex. I had, you know, it just piled up. And I was like, well, there's a lot to deal with there. And so I just took it one thing at a time. And I never did it alone. I always did it with a couple other guys who had done it before me. And I was extremely helpful to have their input and to have them walk alongside me, because the biggest thing that I learned by getting into recovery was that you can't do it alone. It was the same thing with my OCD. I couldn't do it alone, right? I needed a therapist. I needed other people. I needed a counselor. I needed to know other people who had gone before me and or deal with this on a daily basis like I had to. That's how I conquered my resentment, was by making sure it just wasn't about me. I wasn't doing it alone, and knowing that if I kept on hanging on to resentment, it would just smolder and it would turn into a raging fire. And then I would be anxious, and then I would let my OCD take over, and then I would drink in order to calm all that. So
it's like a domino effect.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And anyone in recovery will tell you, dealing with resentments, even on a daily basis, like new resentments, you know, dealing with that and doing a set of steps almost sometimes daily, weekly, monthly, just dealing with those right away. That's the key to happiness as a recovering addict.
It's a daily practice. I think sometimes we have this idea that, you know, someone has reached this peak of success or whatever, and they no longer need to do these daily practices. It reminds me of the book, Atomic Habits. I think the author is James Clear, but anyway, it's all about that. It's a daily thing. It's a daily thing. And,
right.
And I really love what you say about, reaching out for support, and that you can't do it alone. I think you can do a lot alone. You can, and that's really the narrative of our culture today. And I think really with millennials, I think all the generations, there's this underlying thing of like, do it by yourself. And like, you got this, and you do have to have that self-confidence, I think, but we can sometimes feel shame or judgment of ourselves and having to reach out for a hand. It's like, I'm so weak, I'm reaching out, or I feel like, you know, shameful for asking for this support, but we need it. And also it gives the person who's giving us the support such a, you know, it feels good to help somebody.
Yeah. You can't say you're vulnerable and not ask for help.
Yeah. 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 Cause the truth is we all need it.
Kind of hypocritical to say I'm being vulnerable, but then like refuse to ask people for help and try and do it all on your own. Mm. That's not being vulnerable. That's being stubborn. Mm. And we're very careful in this society now to label anything, but I've always seen labels as the key to success, as long as the label is a positive one. So for example, like getting our son diagnosed with autism, like there was something there. There was a problem. He wasn't speaking. It's like you just ignore those things. Those things will become worse. Mm-hmm. Getting a label helped us get help, helped us get funding, helped us get the things that he needs. And now he's 10 and he's brilliant and he's a straight A student. And now during this crisis, he's at home studying 4 different languages.
Wow. He's probably the only one who has it all together.
Probably some days it feels like that.
That's awesome. But
you know, getting like understanding that I was an alcoholic. Somebody once told me, aren't you afraid of what comes along with giving yourself that label? And I said, well, number one, you know, I might be giving myself this label, but everybody else is thinking it. So like, I'm just calling the cat black, right?
Yeah. Well, you're shining a light in that when you face your shit, like you have to shine a light on it, and it's uncomfortable. And it's like,
yeah.
But then you see it and you're like, there it is.
Yeah. Look at it. It's still steaming and it's gross.
Yeah.
And it smells awful. You can't call it a rose, right?
Yeah.
It is what it is. And so just not addressing it, not labeling things sometimes is like fooling yourself, and it's just going to make it worse later on. And I see it every day when dealing with people who continue to relapse and go back out. And sadly, relapse is part of an addict story. And simply because you talk to anybody who's relapsed many times and either finally got it or in the midst of a string of sobriety, they'll always say that there's something there that I haven't addressed. There's someone in my life that I haven't dealt with. And you could be a dry drunk. Someone that we call a dry drunk would be a person who hasn't worked the steps, hasn't dealt with the resentment in their lives, but is sober and not drinking, but they're miserable, right? And that miserableness is evident in the way that they deal with other people, how they deal with life, how they deal with a curveball, how they are in traffic.
It just bleeds out into everyday life.
It bleeds out to everything. Yeah. And my grandfather, God rest his soul, he was sober when he died. But my uncles, who are also in recovery, it's a family disease, said, yeah, you know, grandfather was a dry drunk. He was not always very happy. Mm. And I remember it's like, there's very few times where I remember him smiling, and one time was on his deathbed. But before that, as a kid growing up, the only reason I was able to come, we moved back to BC from Alberta, was because my grandfather decided to get sober. And my mom had said, you're never going to see these kids if you don't get sober. And so he did, but I rarely remember him smiling and being happy and jovial and stuff. And my uncles will echo that. They'll say, yeah, he struggled, right? Even though he was sober, he struggled with certain things. And so, yeah, just dealing with those things that have caused your drinking problem or your drug problem, you know, dealing with those resentments. I just, if I have one, I deal with it right away. Like,
yeah, don't let it fester.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's easier if you just face it right out of the gate and don't let it, you know, I think someone said, don't let it go down into the basement and lift weights, because it's going to come back up twice as strong and punch you in the face.
That's awesome. That is an awesome analogy, because it is so true.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm going to use that.
Feel free.
I won't put my name on it, but that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's true.
It's so true.
Yeah. And I'm so curious too. And I'm just going to check, make sure. Okay. I'm getting carried away. I'm going to start to wrap it up here.
Sure.
I do have a question I think would be really helpful just for anybody. And, you know, when you relapse, it's like you essentially, how do you get back up from failure? Like how, when you relapse and you're like, shit, I've done, it's happened again. And I think in life, it can be translated into anything, you know, like we have a dream and then we stumble and fall on our face. And I think, you know, the story is like to be successful or to get to the place where you're triumphant. I think you have to have, not, you don't have to have, but oftentimes you fall repeatedly. And it's the people who are persistent and just like, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when I would fail, because I can only talk about what worked for me. Mm-hmm. If I failed and I relapsed, first thing I did is I called somebody else. I would call or talk to someone else. And the first step always was right at the beginning was to hook in with other people just like myself. And that was the only way, because no one else will understand. They'll ask questions like, why even take the first drink? Or why did you even bother having another bottle of wine? Or why couldn't you stop? Or why can't you drink normally? Like, they don't understand.
Yeah.
Right. And the solution lies in other people just like yourself and in community. And that's why I say you can't do it alone, because if you try, you'll just continue to fail, because you'll have no one else out there to hold your hand. Like, this is a community program. Recovery is a community program. I can't speak about how grateful I am. There's no words out there and it tears me up every time, but the people who like helped me get sober are the same people I will reach out today. So 5 years, I'll always reach out to the same people. If I feel bad, if I feel like I'm lonely, you know, I always stick to the same four principles. Never get too hungry, never get too anxious, never get too lonely, and never get too tired. So, but if I'm feeling like H-A-L-T, I stop and I call someone.
That's really good. I think that's very useful. Everybody can.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what was taught to me. I didn't come up with this stuff on my own. So when I was relapsing in 2014, it wasn't until I went to my recovery program, walked through those doors, shook a hand, sat down, and let people introduce themselves to me and be open and honest about my problems and say out loud, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, that's kind of when I was given the tools to get back up. And luckily I never had to after I admitted it, but yeah, I've got friends in my program that have, and it's always the reaching out and the asking for help that's brought them back.
That's so powerful and important, especially now. And so like, even if that especially reaching out now is like a phone call or a message or whatever it is that you know you can handle at the moment, just do it. And yeah, to have that community too, I think it's important to make sure we are surrounding ourselves with people that we can, you know, or at least we have one person or two people that we can reach out to that we can trust with that information.
Yeah.
So how I usually wrap these up, which is what we'll start to do, I do a rapid fire. But before we do that, I really want to ask you now, what are you excited about, like looking forward? Because I think especially now it's like, okay, we know what's going on. And even if this wasn't going on, shit in life, it happens. But what's on the horizon for you that makes you feel like, yes, like this is an exciting thing?
I think doing more podcasts, actually. Like, I've been pretty quiet in certain parts of the media. And so like, just, I've been writing a lot, and I'm now at that point where I'm ready to start another book, but I'm looking for another publisher. But also just being good with talking about my story more often, and, you know, taking my vulnerability to another level is key, right? So I'm excited about what all of this, like, there's always a silver lining. So what the virus and the isolation is showing people, certain parts of themselves, like if you're drinking by yourself during the day, during this whole thing, you might have a problem, or you might develop a problem, because that's not normal drinking. Crack open a beer at 10 o'clock in the morning and drink the rest of the day. Like, I don't care what you say, there are things there that you're avoiding. And I know I'm not supposed to judge or diagnose people, but I'm just putting it out there that if this is part of your daily routine, maybe reach out and talk to somebody, maybe do a little bit of reading. So I've had a lot of people reach out and say, you know, I was reading what you wrote today, or I was reading your book today. So, you know, I've got three books out there of poetry that all deal with my journey. And every once in a while, someone reaches out and goes, this really spoke to me. And I'm now looking at my life going, what the hell is going on? Right. And so I'm excited to share my journey, but also like hear other people's journey, help other people, give them the tools that have helped me, and see where they go with it. And, you know, I'm just grateful for the opportunity to hear people, to listen, and to be a part of their journey. So I guess that's what I'm excited about, is just that continues to happen, but more frequently now. So
It's meant to be then. And you're an excellent guest, by the way. Like, this has been awesome. Yeah, genuinely. And too, for everybody listening, as always, links to everything will be in the show notes at realrebelpodcast.com. And the three books are My Sober Little Moon, You Only Love Me When I'm Suffering, and Encyclopedia of a Broken Heart. So all of those will be on the website for you guys to check out. Now into the rapid fire, which you don't need to answer rapidly. Yeah,
that's okay.
I should have some kind of sound effect, like rapid fire.
Yeah, you should have a sound effect there.
I really should add that. Okay, so if you could spend a day in the life in someone else's shoes, who would it be?
Robert Downey Jr.
Oh, I love him.
He's also sober. He's like one of my sober heroes. I'd love to meet him someday. That.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. That's very cool. How do you start your day?
I take a couple of plant-based nutraceuticals to assist me with losing weight.
Ooh, ooh la la. I have to ask, like, what are these?
I'm on this program called Thrive, and it's actually helped me sort of maintain, and I've lost a little bit of weight, but it just helps me maintain manage some joint pain and just keep my energy levels up. And it's been good for me. I can't continue on. It's a little expensive, but at the same time, I've lost like 15 pounds, and I just feel healthier. So I take a couple of those, and I have a shake, and then I take a shower. And if I have my kids, then I spend an hour just getting them ready for the day. And so just a bit of family time.
That's important. A good way to start the day. But I think it's the nutraceuticals that probably are the best part. It's incredible.
Absolutely. There's a bit of caffeine in there. So I haven't been drinking coffee as much. So that's been good, I think, for me anyway. And my anxiety.
Yes. I find matcha tea for me is like I make a matcha tea latte and just with my little whisk and everything every morning. It's the only thing that keeps me steady without anxiety. Like it's...
There you go.
Yeah, it's very important.
Awesome.
What is your favorite childhood memory or one that just like flashes right into your mind?
Playing war as kids. we were always the allies and the axis were always made up, but we would play war in this forest across the street from the house I grew up in. And in the summertime, we always suspected the ice cream truck man was a little weird, like in a bad way. So we would hide in the bushes and we would ambush him. He would come around the corner and he'd have like 20 kids jump out of the bush in camo gear and pretend to blow him up. And that might sound kind of cruel, but you know, he never saw the humor in it, but we thought it was hilarious. And I hope that man didn't have any problems, but it's the one thing that keeps popping up. And maybe I need to find that ice cream man and say sorry, but I'm not sure he's alive anymore.
Or maybe just like tapping into that playful, that like that's
that playful attitude.
Yeah.
We would play war in and around a cemetery, and my mom went traveling out to try and find us one time, and she saw us standing around a grave with our hats on our hearts and holding up a fake flag. And my brother was playing the bugle, and we were honoring this soldier that was buried in this cemetery in Langley. And she took a picture of it. And it's actually, you know, I remember it, but that's actually a good memory. I thought that we were always very respectful and as kids, but playing out those childhood fantasies of going to war. Now you're like, are you kidding me? But back then it's like, you know, we lived in a different time, right? This was the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm old.
Well, I mean, it's all about how you feel on the inside.
That's true. Yeah.
What is your favorite place in the entire world? Like if you could be transported, especially now, if you could be transported anywhere, where would that be?
Paia in New Zealand.
I've never had that one before.
Yeah, I was, before I settled into my corporate job, and after university, I went traveling to New Zealand and bought a little van and I drove around for 2 months. And it was the one place that I go to in my mind on a regular basis. Actually, it's been 20 years since I've been there, but I think about it almost every week.
You travel there often then, mentally?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of beaches, lots of peace and quiet. Yeah, great place.
I'll have to put it on my list.
Yeah, you should.
What is something that you learned this last year?
In 2019, I learned that I am a good person and that I deserve the love of somebody who can see that. And it's not like my ex never saw that I was a good person. She regularly tells me I'm a good man. But, you know, our paths and our journey took us to a place where we couldn't love each other romantically anymore. And, you know, that's a key to a good marriage, too, is the romance part of it. And there was just too much there that had happened that to repair, and lots of therapy couldn't fix that. So I mean, we're happier this way. And so through that split, I learned that there is someone out there for me that deserves what I'm able to bring to the table, and that I deserve that person's love equally. And so I learned a lot about relationships, about myself, and how I act in relationships. And, you know, I did a set of steps with myself and dealt with that. I did some relationship courses with Mark Groves. I did a lot of stuff to work on that. He is awesome.
Yeah,
I've had the pleasure of meeting him a couple of times and just chatting with him. And we have similar backgrounds, but he is, he's just on another level in terms of how he expresses, you know, what people need to work on when it comes to relationships. That's not my area of expertise. And so I always rely on other people in their expertise to yep. show me what I need to work on and how to become a better person. And that was key to me, yeah, understanding what it was about myself that I needed to address, in addition to everything else I'm addressing on a regular basis, mm-hmm. to be in a good spot for another relationship. So yeah, that's what I learned about myself. Long answer.
No, I love long answers. And I think that too, it's very like, you know, your previous partners can only meet you to the level at which you like yourself and believe that you're a good person. So you were resonating at a certain level as how you felt about yourself. And that's the, you know, where your ex could meet you.
That's right.
I've had Mark on the podcast, so I'm going to also link his episode in the show notes in case people are curious. I want to hear more about him. Because we totally just talked him up because he is.
That's right.
That awesome. Final three questions. What is a book or book recommendation, that you would share that you think would help people? Something that pops into mind, something you're reading, you know, right now or read recently?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not reading a lot right now. And that's only because I've just been so caught up. But you know what? If I'm going to be completely honest, I think everybody should read The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because even if you're not an alcoholic, you will learn something about yourself and you'll learn something about people in your life. Because you talk to anybody, anyone, they'll know someone who has a problem with something. Mm-hmm. And you've either judged that person for it or it's very clear that they do have a problem. So I don't know. I think it's one of those books that you can see in a self-help area, but you never read because you don't think you're an alcoholic or you aren't. But I think everybody should read it. There's a lot of stuff in there that, you know, you will help you on a spiritual journey. If you're on one, it should be considered as part of required reading. You don't have to align yourself with it. That's totally your call. But you'll definitely read something in there that will speak to you. Cool. I guarantee it.
I like it.
Yeah.
We've never had that one before either. You're bringing a lot of new ideas and things, which is awesome. This is my favorite question. And everybody asks this question, but I don't care. If you were sitting across the table from your 20-year-old self and you could say one thing, what would you say?
My 20-year-old self. I would say, keep writing and play as much music and write as much music as you can, because at some point it's going to stop. Because it wouldn't matter what I would tell myself. When I'm 20, I would still go out and become an alcoholic, because you can't tell an alcoholic to do anything. They're just going to continue to do what they want because there's something wrong with their ability to say no to things. So I would just encourage myself to enjoy my 20s as much as possible and just make sure you don't hurt anybody.
I like it. Final question. What is your rebel cause? Meaning, why are you doing what you're doing and why do you feel you're here?
My purpose is pretty clear. Like I want to encourage people to be vulnerable to the point where they recognize what's going on in their lives and that it's okay to ask for help to get through it. Because I find that, a lot of people that I talk to are scared to ask for help and scared to take that step into a community that will allow them to get the help that they need. So it's mental health. That's addiction, addiction to anything really, because a lot of people are afraid to make that first step and it holds people back and it kills them too. It keeps them from seeking out the hand that will help guide them to the next place in their life. Because I think as a society, as you said, we're raised and we're bombarded with this, a lot of different messages that at its core, says we can do this on our own and we can't. Like, so, you know, that's why this quarantine is tough, because we're now faced with just having to do things on our own physically, right? Mm-hmm. So find a Zoom meeting of someone, talk to somebody, call somebody, FaceTime somebody.
Yeah.
Do a podcast.
Yes. It's incredibly helpful.
Sorry.
We're freezing again. Yeah. We'll take that as a sign. The screen just froze. So it's time for us to call it a day. As usual, I have gone well over my expected time. So thank you so much for coming on. It was really, truly a pleasure.
It was my pleasure, Katie. Thank you.
Hey, it's your host, Katie B, and thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Real Rebel Podcast. It really is an honor to have you here. And as I mentioned in the beginning, anything that we talked about on this episode, including all of John's books, can be found over at realrebelpodcast.com in the show notes. And if you like this episode, you might also enjoy, if you don't already, the audio coffee episode that comes out every single Monday, which is designed to help you get your week started off on the right foot. It's super awesome. There is a riff, a card pull, and a Monday mashup on every single episode. So keep your eyes or your ears peeled for that. Music for the intro on this episode is a custom track done by my guy Nathan from Extra Deluxe, and music played throughout this outro is called Deep Blue by Dusty Marshall, both of which you can find links to in the show notes. Okay, until next time.